Hélène. The Auvergne, France, March 1st, 1944. It is dark as pitch. I have no idea where Hubert is, and this strange little Frenchman is trying to get me into his car. I slide my hand closer to my coat pocket, and therefore the revolver hidden inside. I'm not going anywhere until you tell me who you are and where to find Hubert.
My name is Henri Tardiva, and I am trying to deliver you to him.
I have room in my life for only one Henri, and it's not this man, so I make a mental note to call him Tardiva, and then ask, why?
I am your contact.
I do not tell him that our contact's name is Maurice Southgate and that we have been instructed in no uncertain terms not to use a vehicle of any sort. London has assured us that the Germans have commandeered most of the civilian vehicles in this area. Barring the option of a train, we are to bike or walk to our rendezvous point. Since we see neither trains nor bicycles available at the moment, however, our remaining option feels less than ideal in the dead of night in unknown territory. And then, of course, there is the issue of my co-conspirator. I cannot leave without him. I'm not getting in that car without Hubert. Tardiva tips his head to the side, pulls at his cigarette, then blows the smoke out his nostrils.
Are you always so difficult?
I assure you this is the agreeable version of myself. There is a rustle in the bushes beside Tardiva.
It's true,
Hubert says. Voice deadpan as he steps out of the hedgerow.
This is about as pleasant as she gets.
About time, I mutter, as he brushes dried leaves from his coat. He looks altogether calm standing there in the dark, as though there's nothing odd about this meeting.
I sent this chap to collect you, he says.
And why didn't you come along?
I was burying my chute.
Hubert eyes the pile of silver nylon under Tardivar's arm with concern. He scowls at me for breaking the rules.
There's no time to explain, so I say, we need to find our friend and be on our way. About that.
Tardiva snuffs out his cigarette between thumb and forefinger, then flicks it into the bushes.
Maurice Southgate sends his regards. He's in a bit of trouble with the local Gestapo. He won't be meeting you tonight.
Hubert's face is hidden in shadow, so I cannot see his expression, but we exchange a quick glance nonetheless. The fact that he knows Southgate's real name is a good sign, but we can't be sure how he came by it.
What exactly does that mean? Hubert asks.
Southgate got caught up in a German raid near Montluçon and has likely been arrested. Or killed. I'm not sure which.
I am exhausted, cold, and hungry. My dinner was far from satisfactory, but I still regret leaving it on the floor of the Liberator. And you know this because... Tardiva shrugs in that nonchalant French way, as though we have all the time in the world to stand in a damp forest in the middle of the night and chat. It's infuriating. I want to grab his shoulders and shake him so hard his teeth rattle.
He sent word to me, he says. Be grateful. Otherwise, there would have been no one to greet you.
Hubert tightens the belt around his coat. The air is growing colder.
And our other associate?
Southgate was only one of two men we were supposed to meet at the drop zone. The other is Dennis Rake, our radio operator.
A no-show. I suppose you're the one who lit the fires.
Hubert asks.
Standard procedure. The planes have to be signaled somehow. You aren't the first lot to fall out of the sky, you know.
Indeed we're not. Counterintelligence missions have gone up 700% in the last year. And yet, what London cannot prepare you for are the myriad decisions that must be made on the ground when things do not go according to plan. To trust a stranger or not, to bury your chute or allow it to be purloined, to accept a ride or hike instead. But Tardiva is losing patience.
Listen, do you want me to take you to Gaspar or not? If so, you need to get in the car, because I'm not walking. His encampment is over 20 kilometers away in Montmouchet, and there are other places I have to be tonight. There is no need to confer. For better or worse, Tardivar knows a great deal about our affairs. At the moment, he is our only option.
Lead the way, Hubert says.
While Tardivar is stuffing my parachute into the trunk of his car, I tug on the sleeve of Hubert's coat and whisper, Denden? It's our code name for Dennis Rake. He refused to parachute into the Auvergne with us, demanding instead to be flown onto a private landing strip 2 days ago on a small Lysander. The man does not jump from planes or like guns, and he'd be no use to the war effort whatsoever if he wasn't the best radio operator this side of the Atlantic Ocean. However, we were assured that Southgate and Rake would meet us here, and together we would find the Makisar leader known as Gaspar to begin operations. I now wonder if we've all fallen into an elaborate trap. Hubert shakes his head.
No idea.
We slide into the back seat of the small two-door Renault, and I know that somewhere in the deep pockets of Hubert's trousers are a pair of service revolvers identical to mine. And I'm certain that, like mine, his hand hovers nearby, ready to fire them into the back of Tardivar's skull should things go badly from here. Whatever else I might think of Henri Tardivar, he is a superb driver. Within moments, he's navigated us through the forest floor and onto a narrow, winding back road, all with the headlights off. He whistles softly to himself and hangs one arm out the open window. The air is brisk and it smells of old leaves and frost, but it keeps us awake as we drive.
Don't worry, he says sometime later, when Hubert protests him turning onto another byway. The Germans stick to the Route Nationale.
Why?
You'll see.
And indeed we do. The farther we drive into the Auvergne, the rougher the terrain gets. In the 10 years that I have lived in this country, I have heard this area referred to as the Fortress of France, but I never knew why until now. The little car climbs ever higher through the hills without so much as a groan of protest as those same hills turn to mountains, many of them over 6,000 feet. The byway disintegrates into a dirt road that is pitted and meandering and almost impossible to navigate. We wind through seemingly endless plateaus and around volcanic rock formations, occasionally drifting perilously close to gorges whose bottoms we cannot see in the dark. Wooded slopes spring up on all sides, and the road softens beneath a blanket of pine needles. I must confess that it is perfect terrain for the Makisar to wage their unique brand of guerrilla warfare. And instructions from London notwithstanding, walking would have been exhausting and a bicycle utterly worthless. It is 3 o'clock in the morning when we pass through an opening in a low stone wall and pull up to the chateau at Montmouchet. It sits alone in the middle of a large field without so much as a single ornamental hedge or tree out front. It is old, solid, large, and square. Pieces of pale stone are crumbling off the corners, but otherwise it appears intact and impenetrable. All the lights on the first floor are blazing, and the circular driveway is packed with crushed rock and an endless supply of small flatbed trucks and rusty Renaults. There must be 30 or more, parked at haphazard angles all around the chateau. Cars, cars everywhere, when London said they were rarer than sugar in wartime.
Stolen, Tardivar offers before I can ask. Though, to be fair, the Makisar only target non-collaborationists. They'd be confiscated by the Germans anyway. We might as well get some use out of them.
Where do they get the petrol to power so many vehicles? Hubert asks.
Most of those are gasogène, coal-fueled vehicles, and coal is easy enough to come by in these parts.
Tardivar peels himself out of the car and stretches.
Wait here. Gaspar does not like surprises.
We watch as he saunters across the drive, hops up the front steps, and pounds on the broad double doors. Once he's slipped inside, I turn to Hubert. Do you think he's going to kill us? He leans his head against the back of the seat and yawns so wide that his jaw pops. He closes his eyes.
If so, I hope he's quick about it. I'm exhausted.
After several moments, the front doors swing open again,
and the small Renault is illuminated by a rectangle of yellow light. "He's waving us in," I say. "For better or worse, here we go." Hubert and I grab our packs, situate our weapons within easy reach, and walk into the house, only to find it occupied by 50 of the most surly, suspicious-looking Frenchmen I have ever seen. A quick introduction proves them to be dirty-minded, foul-mouthed, and irritated by our presence. A den of thieves indeed. But they are not Germans, and that is an immeasurable relief.
"Gaspard will arrive in the morning," Tardiva says. "You can wait up with this lot, or you can try to get some sleep. Your choice."
A brief glance at Hubert, and the decision is made. "Sleep." He nods to a long, lean Maquisard standing at the foot of the stairs.
"This is Judex, Gaspard's chief lieutenant. He will see you up to your room."
"And what of you?" Henri Tardiva grins and offers me an exaggerated wink.
"You are not the only ripe fruit that must be plucked out of a tree tonight, madame."
I want to hate the man, but I can't quite muster the animosity, even when the Maquisards leer. The truth is, I've never met an Henri whom I didn't like. Tardiva evades my retort by escaping through the front doors. The interior of the house is much like the exterior. The floorboards are battered, but none of them squeak. The plastered walls are chipped in places, but not discolored. The tapestries frayed, but numerous, and the furniture, though old, is stolid and austere. Who and where the original tenants are, we're never told. But I can surmise that they are an unshakable lot. We follow Judex up three flights of stairs and down a long hallway to the only empty bedroom in Chateau Montmouchet. He opens the door, then leaves without a word. There is a single window, a washstand, and a double bed. There is no chair, couch, or even a rug on the floor for one of us to sleep on. Hubert curses, I groan, and we glare at each other in a standoff for several seconds. But there's no point making a scene. I am too exhausted to argue. "Give me the left side and you can sleep on top of the covers," I say.
"That's a very specific request."
"Left is my psychological side."
"I do not believe there is any such thing as a psychological side of the bed."
This is what happens when your partner is a former soldier turned academic. Creativity takes a backseat to logic. "Of course there is. My husband sleeps on the right side of the bed and I have the left. Psychologically speaking, I cannot sleep otherwise. That's my offer. Take it or leave it."
"I fear your husband would kill me if he knew."
"My husband is not the one you need to fear tonight. Just stay on your side." He shrugs.
"Fair enough."
Our backpacks, along with my purse, are stuffed under the bed, and we claim our respective sides in silence. I hand Hubert my coat and crawl under the blankets, trying not to think of who might have used this bed last or what took place within. Both of us secure a loaded revolver under our pillows. I pull the sheets up to my chin. Hubert burrows beneath his pile of coats, and we are asleep in seconds. We wake sometime later to raucous shouting and slamming doors. The entire house vibrates, and I can hear little trails of plaster dust sliding down the walls. It is not yet dawn, but there are ribbons of pale sky along the horizon.
"Do those buggers never sleep?" Hubert groans beside me.
"I'd wager Gaspard has arrived."
"Should we greet him then?"
I shake my head, and my hair rustles against the coarse linen pillowcase. "No," I whisper. "They think we're asleep." Hubert is silent for a moment, pondering.
"We have the advantage then."
"He'll know we're here."
"Which means they're discussing us."
"But," I say, "I'd bet they left Judex on the stairs. They're a ruddy awful lot of pigs, but they aren't entirely stupid." Hubert is at the window, peering down in a matter of seconds.
"As I recall, you were quite adept at the ropes course in Kent."
"So?"
"We're in luck. These horrid men have supplied us with a perfectly adequate trellis that reaches all the way to the ground."
Despite excelling at the ropes course, I did not in fact enjoy the training exercise, nor do I particularly like putting it into practice as I shimmy down 3 floors of rickety trellis after Hubert. Despite the age and questionable construction of the wooden slats themselves, the wisteria vines are strong and established, and thanks to a late winter, mercifully bare of leaves. We are on the ground in no time. "These poor fools need all the help they can get," I whisper as we creep around the side of the chateau toward what appears to be a kitchen. "Worst security I've ever seen. There's not a guard in sight."
"They left Judex on the stairs. They probably have lookouts at the windows. It's impossible to sneak up on the house."
"But not," I say, "to sneak around it."
The kitchen windows are low and open, and the smells of coffee and porridge drift out from them and into the pre-dawn air. My stomach complains, and I count the hours since eating that ill-advised spam sandwich. Hubert shakes his head at the sound as though to say, "Get that under control," and we settle into what was once a herb bed. At the moment, it is occupied by sparse little plants that have turned dry and brittle with neglect. We try not to snap any branches as we take our spots. Hubert looks a little puzzled by the rapid colloquial French that's bantered about inside. He's the pure academic sort who learned from professors and textbooks, whereas I learned the language from Stephanie and Henri and the streets themselves, so I translate as needed. Soon enough, I can distinguish Gaspar from the others, even though I cannot see him. He is loud and brash and domineering. He cuts off his lieutenants constantly, dismissing their ideas and observations. Arrogant, surly, self-satisfied. He sounds like a bully, and I dislike him immediately.
"Oh," I whisper, the sound of my voice little more than that of a breath. "They're talking about us now."
"And?"
"He has no interest in cooperating with London."
"Then why the bloody hell are we here?"
"He believes he will be receiving aid from de Gaulle's Free French forces in North Africa."
I listen a bit longer, then snort.
"It is seen as disloyalty to take aid from les Britanniques."
The conversation inside the kitchen notches up rapidly, and I lean my head against the wall to listen. If Hubert cannot keep up, I'll fill him in later.
"What do we do with these 2 Britanniques, then?" one of Gaspar's lieutenants asks. "Tadivad drove off and left them here."
"Get rid of them. I don't care how."
A pause, and then,
"We suspect the woman is carrying a lot of money with her."
There is a long silence, and I can hear a coffee cup sliding across the table. A slurp.
"How much?" "We don't know. But she is very calm, sure of herself. Both of them carry large packs."
"Radios, perhaps?"
"No."
Gaspar asks,
"Are they armed?"
"We believe so."
Fingers tap an eager staccato against the table. When he finally speaks again, Gaspar's solution is stunning in its nonchalance.
"One of us will have to seduce the woman, then kill her and relieve her of the money."
There is a great deal of foot stomping, hooting, and volunteering at this proclamation. Gaspar sounds intrigued.
"She is attractive?"
"Très sexy,"
a man says, laughing, then goes on to describe my finer points, not the least of which apparently include straight teeth, shiny hair, a small waist, and gros seins. I glance down at my breasts in curiosity. Interesting. I've always thought Frenchmen preferred a diminutive bosom. Hubert shakes his head, horrified. Apparently he understands a bit more country French than he lets on. Several of the men suggest that I might be shared among them before I'm dispatched. One of them offers to go collect me at once. There is some talk about how they will get into the room without getting shot, and what to do if I resist or if Hubert tries to intervene.
"Assez!"
Gaspar shouts, bringing order back to the room.
"I will do it."
"And the man?"
one of his lieutenants asks.
"Kill him too."
Nancy Grace Augusta Wake. Hearst Newspaper Group, Paris Headquarters, 1936.
We can't publish this, my editor says. He slides the stack of papers back across his desk toward me with the tip of one finger as though they are contaminated. I blink at him. I am exhausted and unwashed and not my sharpest at this particular moment. The entire article was written longhand on a notepad I bought at the Anhalter Bahnhof train station as Frank and I left Berlin. I returned to my flat long enough to type it and change my clothes before delivering it to Milo Caron, my editor. I expected any number of things after he read the article, but rejection wasn't one of them.
I don't understand.
I look at Frank sitting beside me and then back at Milo. I cannot submit your article, he says again, but slower this time as though I am stupid.
Why not? It is a great article.
Because I've got a man in Berlin right now. A man I sent on assignment to cover this story.
And you've got a woman in your office right now with a finished article.
I slam my fist down on the desk and instantly regret it because a bolt of pain shoots into the back of my elbow. Shit, I have got to work on my temper. I cradle my elbow in my other hand, rubbing the bone with my thumb.
Hearst is an award-winning syndicate, not some tabloid like Seventage. This is an important story. I sent my best guy.
Guy? I ask, with enough fury in my voice that Frank shrinks back several inches.
Did your guy go to Vienna? Did he see whippings?
Milo runs a thumb over his chin, scratches the stubble. He doesn't answer my question.
No one who reads our newspapers will take your article seriously.
Why not? They took you seriously when you published that photograph on the front page. That's what sent us to Vienna and then to Berlin. The entire world has now seen what the brown shirts can do with a whip.
I published photographic evidence.
It's the truth, Frank says. I saw every bit of it myself.
Which is why you took photographs, I presume? Photographs I can submit alongside it as proof?
He glares at each of us in turn.
I took pictures and they were destroyed, along with my camera, smashed to bits in Vienna, just like she said, in her article.
Frank's face is red and splotchy, and I'm delighted to see that it is not embarrassment but anger that's lit him up like a campfire. But I cut him off before he can continue.
If three eyewitness accounts aren't enough for you, what is?
Do you need counting lessons? I see two people here.
I brush a piece of lint from my skirt. Me, Frank, and Janosch Liebermann. Milo's face pales a bit at the name. I'm not supposed to know it. Janosch was never named by the paper.
You may have published the photo, but I got the interview. Me, not your guy in Berlin. It's written and ready for publication as well.
I stand and prepare to leave.
But it's become quite clear that you are not interested in my work.
Which is a pity because, as you well know, these articles are printed in a dozen cities throughout the US. I can only imagine what William Randolph Hearst would think if you lost this particular scoop. No matter, though. I'm sure there's some other tabloid that would be willing to publish my interview.
Milo's voice takes on a conciliatory tone. Where is Liebermann?
Gone.
Where?
Across an ocean, far away.
Which ocean?
I feign stupidity.
How many of them are there again? I don't know how to count.
There is an art to French cursing that I'm nowhere near perfecting, but I'm once again inspired to apply myself when Milo explodes in the most impressive display, first excoriating me for insubordination and then for my actions themselves.
You let him leave the country?
No, I helped him. His story in exchange for a transit visa.
You know where he's gone? How to reach him?
Of course. Put me in contact.
Submit it, I say, sliding my article back in front of him. Or I sell Janosch's interview to the highest bidder. I'm just a freelancer after all. Frank gallantly opens the door for me, and I slam it on our way out.
That was ballsy,
Frank says when we're standing outside, looking up at Milo's fifth floor office window. I rub my temples and close my eyes. My eyelids feel like they're lined with sandpaper. I can't decide whether I want to eat an entire loaf of bread smeared with butter or throw up on the sidewalk. It was stupid.
Maybe. But at least he didn't win. That's something.
You're a good egg, Frank. You know that, right?
By which you mean you're awfully fond of me, but not the least bit attracted.
I give him a lopsided smile. No hard feelings?
Nah, just a bit of bruised pride. Nothing some good old French brandy won't fix.
I'm really sorry about your camera. He chucks my chin with his knuckles.
Cameras can be replaced. People can't.
And then Frank Gilmore plants a sloppy kiss on my forehead and turns to leave. Hey. He looks over his shoulder.
Yeah?
You realize that all the articles and photographs in the world won't be enough to stop what's coming, right? A shadow crosses his face.
I know.
So, what do we do?
When the time comes, we fight.
I am weeping and puffy-eyed when Stephanie finds me. The only thing I hate more than crying is to be found crying. But here she is, waltzing into my bathroom, with Picon under one arm and a towel under the other. Get up, she says. We're leaving. What are you doing here? I drop lower into the tub. Thank God for bubbles. You did want the dog back, no? Because I'm not keeping him. Of course. I mean, what are you doing in my bathroom? How did you get my key? You gave it to me before you left? She looks at the ceiling and sighs as though I am an imbecile. And I have come to collect you.
For what?
An excursion. I don't have the heart to go out tonight, Steph. Picon whimpers at the sound of my voice, and Stephanie lowers him to the ground. He skitters across the floor, his little nails clicking against the tile, and rises up on his hind legs beside the tub, trying to see me. I have something a little grander than a night on the town in mind, and you need it. You look awful, ma petite. I lean my head back against the lip of the tub, close my eyes, and let my arm hang over the edge. Picon licks my puckered fingertips and I scratch him behind the ears. I have always loved the way you encourage and nurture others, especially while they are under duress. It is true. It is mean. I am not known for being nice. Well, I am not known for enjoying insults. There is a sound that only French women can make. It is one of impatience and exasperation, and is spoken with breath, not words. I envy them this skill. Enough, she says. Get dressed. I'm taking you on holiday for a week. I open one eye, lift a brow.
Holiday?
You need to get away to take your mind off things. A week? What about your husband? Besides, I have work to do. I don't know exactly what I want to say, so I lift one hand and wave it around, flinging water drops across her skirt. You submitted your article. Your work is done. And the Count is in Spain on business. He's left me with nothing to do but spend his money, and I don't want to do it here. Get up. No. Nancy, you're being ridiculous. I'm not getting up while you're in this bathroom. I do have a little bit of dignity, you know. I've never seen the whites of Stephanie's eyes before, but they are on full display when she rolls them. Good grief. We have the same parts. So blunt. So French. Are they embarrassed at nothing? Regardless, I cross my arms and sink even farther beneath the bubbles. We are not that close of friends. She mutters something about prudish Australians as she drops the towel on the floor and retreats into my tiny living room. But now, I'm intrigued. And just where exactly do you plan on taking me? I shout after her. Marseille. Marseille. It looks like a painting, Marseille is a city of hilltop villas and sleek yachts, tile roofs, beryl seas, tanned legs, twisting narrow streets. Its central thoroughfare, the Canebière, leads from the glinting waters of the Mediterranean straight into hills that drip with grapevines. It smells of salt water, baking bread and bouillabaisse, of fresh basil and daylilies. There are fish markets and casinos, hotels and dance halls, bistros, beaches, cafes, tiny little parks that are half the size of a city block, and flowers everywhere. It is a cascade of colour. It is overwhelming in the most delicious way. "I'm never leaving," I tell Stephanie as I roll onto my side and rub Picon between his sweet floppy ears. We lie beneath an umbrella on the beach as the sun begins its downward slide.
"I told you so," she says, stretching out on her towel.
"You were right, I'm not afraid to say it. This was a brilliant idea." We arrived at 8 this morning, having taken the night train. Stephanie booked us a private compartment, and we arrived well-rested and eager to see the city. The streets were empty except for a few tradesmen and gardeners headed to work. On the Canebière, workmen were hosing down the sidewalks with perfumed water. "That seems a bit excessive," I said, as we dodged a particularly aggressive spray on the way to our hotel. There were a few stragglers still out from the night before, dressed in their evening finery, and they walked through the water, filling the streets with laughter.
"It's a port city, ma petite. Lots of fish. The smell is otherwise very..."
She waved her hand around, searching for an English word.
"Aggressive."
After chucking our suitcases into the room, she took me directly to the nearest shop and made me buy a new bathing suit. Now I feel as though I'm lying about in my underwear. I've never worn a two-piece bathing suit before. But Stephanie insists that since I possess a double portion of bosom, I should wear a suit with double the pieces. I've given up arguing with her. Besides, compared to everyone else on this beach, Stephanie included, I look fully clothed. We begin to gather our things when we can no longer feel the warm tingle of sun on our skin. All around us, people are coming in from the water, stretching on their towels, and loading up what's left of late afternoon picnics.
"You'll like this next part,"
Stephanie says, as she pulls a light sundress over her shoulders. I push onto my elbows and squint up at her. She stands in front of me, blocking the sun, looking for all the world like an angel in some Renaissance painting. "What comes next?"
"We play."
We spend every other day in Marseille much like the first, with one notable difference. We sleep until noon. I wake each morning to birdsong and bright light drifting through my open window. The sun is warm, the breeze is fresh, and I am pleasantly sore in new places from days spent walking through steep, narrow streets and up grassy hills. In the last 6 days, I have learned to gamble. I prefer blackjack to craps. Let out a mainsail, eat oysters on the half shell, buy lingerie, press grapes, and most important, relax. Slowly, all the knots in my shoulders have softened. My worries have faded. On our last morning in Marseille, we have mimosas for breakfast, scallops for lunch, and then we spend another long, lazy day on the beach. I am sun-soaked and water-logged, and after a short midday nap beneath my umbrella, Stephanie convinces me to go exploring one last time. We visit the Calanques, tall white cliffs that tower over the Mediterranean and span 20 kilometers between Marseille and Cassis. One section near the city is shorter than most, and we sit for an hour watching a group of young, handsome men swan dive into the blue water below. "That," Stephanie says, pointing to a crumbling stone fortress on an island far out in the bay,
"is the Château d'If. It was once a great fortress. Then it became a prison. Now it is a tourist attraction. Perhaps one day we will come back and we can rent a boat and take a closer look. I have never been inside."
I like the idea of traipsing along the high walls and through the towers, and I tell her as much. Picon lies on my lap, spread out flat on his back, exposing himself shamelessly. I rub his little pink belly and giggle when his tongue lolls out the side of his mouth. And that, Stephanie says after a while, turning to point up the mountain where a basilica sits at the highest point overlooking the city, is the Notre Dame de la Garde. It is Marseille's best-known symbol. You will not find a more beautiful building in this entire city, perhaps in all of France. I am told that merely stepping inside will make you religious.
Then I will appreciate it from here, I say, and she laughs.
On our way back into the city, we walk by the Marseille Cathedrale de la Majore and the Vieux-Port. Everywhere I look, there are brightly painted buildings and flower boxes bursting with blooms. Cafes, yachts, vendors, shops filled with more little luxuries than I could ever afford in 10 lifetimes. Our time here is like being in a dream, and slowly, 1 hour at a time, I forget the horrors that I witnessed in Vienna and Berlin. Do you think Milo will submit your article? Stephanie asks as we walk back to our hotel. Her question yanks me out of the dream I've been floating in. I don't know. If he doesn't, I will have the Count speak with him.
Your husband knows Milo?
He knows everyone, ma petite. How do you think he was able to get Janos that transit visa?
I have long since stopped wondering about such things. You work miracles, I just take it as fact at this point.
We continue down the Canebière for some time in silence. Picon sits in the crook of my arm, yapping at every dog, cat, and bird he sees.
What are we doing tonight? I ask.
Stephanie throws her arms into the air and spins in a circle.
Tonight we dance. You can't be serious. What is life for, ma petite, if not for dancing?
Welcome to the playground of Coco Chanel and Somerset Maugham, Stephanie says, waving one long elegant arm as we stand before Le Bar de la Marine. The bar faces the Vieux-Port, Marseille's natural harbour. It is 3 stories tall, has stuccoed walls, a huge courtyard filled with wrought iron tables, and flower boxes that spill over with twisty vines and fragrant pink blossoms. Snippets of unfamiliar music drift from the open windows. Somewhere, inside, a band is warming up. What are those instruments? Stephanie tilts her head to the side, listening.
Strings, tambourine, and an accordion.
She dismisses my groan with the wave of a hand.
There would be no tango without the accordion. You will learn to love it in the end.
Oh, surely not. Stephanie, I don't know how to tango. My wicked little friend grins. Yet. As it turns out, learning the tango is a bit like learning French itself. I do much better when I ignore the rules. Not to say that I don't move properly, but rather that I go by instinct. Yes, the dance fails if I don't point my toe at my partner's spine on an outside step. But if I stand there thinking about how I'm not properly pointing my toe, then the whole thing really does go tits up. So I feel my way through. Thankfully, Stephanie had us arrive at Le Bar de la Marine an hour before most of the other patrons. I have the opportunity for a basic lesson before I'm thrust into the fray. And as with the language, I find the learning process far more enjoyable when I am cheek to cheek with a handsome Frenchman. We discover in short order that this particular establishment has no lack of willing dance partners, and before long I've had enough brandy and turns around the dance floor to feel comfortable with the basics. Stephanie, damn her, was right again. We dance and drink and laugh the night away, hardly speaking 5 words to each other all the while. I cannot actually remember the last time I laughed this hard. My partners are good-humoured when I step on their toes and when I miss the count. They tease me gently in French, and I laugh. Soul-filling, heart-lifting laughter. I feel as though I'm floating, as though my bones have gone soft, like I don't have a care in the world, and yes, I'm aware that likely has as much to do with the brandy as it does with dancing, but I don't care. This is my last night in Marseille, and I mean to enjoy it. Before this trip, I did not own a single evening gown, but I now have one, and it is perfect. The dress is satin, floor length, purple and looks fabulous with my borrowed pearls. It is open in the back all the way to my waist, and my dance partner finds this feature a little too fascinating. He keeps trying to slide his hand beneath the fabric, and I keep having to warn him about a knee to the groin. "Did you know," I say casually at the end of a lazy twirl, "that scar tissue forms inside a man's testicles every time he gets hit in the groin? It just stays there, building up over time, clogging up the knackers." It's somewhat dim in the dance hall, so I can't be sure, but I think his face pales a bit at this. If nothing else, his hand stays where it's supposed to from then on. We are on our second tango together, my 9th of the evening, and I am pulled against his lean chest when a little prickling begins along the back of my neck, as though I am being watched. I count off the steps in my head, trying not to break our rhythm as I look around the room. Slow, slow, quick, quick, slow, whirl, again, slow, slow, quick, quick, slow, whirl, dip. I am bent over backward, my partner's mouth dangerously close to caressing my neck, when I see him. Henri Fiocca. Even upside down, he is every bit as beautiful as he was that night at the Pont Royal. Wide brown eyes, heavy lashes, full mouth, dark brows, high cheekbones. Once vertical again, I am only somewhat surprised to see a stunning blonde woman on his arm. Fiocca is wearing a nicely tailored suit and a pocket square. The blonde is wearing as little as she can get away with. He is staring at me, and she is glaring at him. Stephanie did warn me about that, notorious with the women. So, as my partner whirls me around once again, I do my best to pretend that I never saw him at all.
Henri. He knows that laugh. He'd recognize it anywhere, in fact, full-throated and warm, self-deprecating as though she's laughing at herself and inviting everyone else to join in. The very sound of it makes his ears warm. It's that woman from the Pont Royal, the one with the black hair and the blue eyes. "Why won't you dance with me, Henri?" Oh, Marceline. He has completely forgotten her. Just like that, one breath of laughter from that woman, and he's lost all interest in his companion. No, that's not fair. He wasn't interested to begin with, only bored and lonely. And Marceline, as ever, was persistent. She wanted a night out, so he reluctantly obliged, even though he knows better. "I'm a terrible dancer," he says. It's a lie, of course, but Marceline has been trying to run her stockinged foot up his pant leg for the last hour, and there's no telling what would happen if he submitted to a tango. Find himself unwittingly affianced by next month, no doubt.
"Then you'll have to take me out again."
She curls her lips into a perfect rose-colored pout, then a corner of her mouth twists higher when she sees that he's noticed. Henri's father loves brazen women like this, loves being chaste. He wants to be convinced of the challenge, to deem it worthy, because that's what it is in the end when a woman throws herself at you. Just a challenge, a game, bait and switch. She reels you in and then you spend the rest of your life trying to catch her. It's exhausting and insubstantial. Once you've gotten a woman like Marceline, what do you actually do with her? That's not a question his father has ever been able to adequately answer, and he's gone through 4 wives as a result. The real trouble, however, is that he wants Henri to like the same kind of woman, to like Marceline specifically. But this is just one of the many ways in which he is not in the least bit like his father. That laughter echoes above the music again, and Henri cannot help but smile. Marceline thinks the smile is for her, and she leans closer. He is in danger of being kissed, so he pushes back from the table. Again, that pout, but disappointed now instead of provocative, and a question in her calculating eyes. "Excusez-moi," Henri says. "I must visit les toilettes." A narrow escape. He doesn't enjoy lying to women, but has been known to use the tool occasionally in the act of self-preservation. He does visit the men's room before going in search of the raven-haired girl from Paris. Le Bar de la Marine is crowded tonight, and it's easy to blend into the throng as he edges his way around the room. Henri scans the tables and the clusters of partygoers who lean against the bar and gather in the doorways. He looks for bent heads kissing, afraid she might be among them. And he looks for dark heads thrown back in amusement, for bright white teeth and soft curves. Nowhere. He can't find her anywhere. Henri is beginning to wonder if he imagined the sound, if he summoned it with his longing. But then he hears the familiar cascade again. She's only 10 feet away, on the dance floor, in the arms of some other man in a poorly tailored suit. She is either new to the tango or he is a terrible dancer, because there is nothing fluid about their movements, and not for lack of proximity. The man is holding her close enough to make Henri's jaw clench, but there is no chemistry between them. He feels both relief at this discovery and an intense dislike for the man. She is counting off the steps, trying not to miss them, when her partner bends her backward into a dip one beat too early. Her lips purse in annoyance as her long, slender neck bends in a gentle arc. Her hair spills like ink onto the floor. And she sees Henri. He is certain she sees him because there is a tightening at the corners of those wide blue eyes. Recognition. She remembers. "A friend of yours?" Marceline asks, hand sliding into the crook of his arm. There is a possessive note to her voice that irritates him, and he struggles not to pull his arm away. For the second time tonight, Henri has failed to notice her presence. "We have a mutual friend." Again, the truth, but just barely. "She does not dance well." No wonder his father loves Marceline, a pretty face and a caustic heart. He shrugs. "Come, I did not mean to abandon you." The music winds to a close and the band takes a break. Henri leads Marceline away and the dance floor clears enough for him to see his laughing girl return to her table across the room. And, ha, Stéphanie Marsic is there as well. Not that he is surprised. She has been insisting for months that he meet this friend of hers. Her presence is the opening he needs, though, given the number of men surrounding their table, a short one. Now or never, he decides. "I think it's time I get you home." Henri knows there is a wide gap in understanding between his meaning and Marceline's interpretation, but he lets it stand. Her smile is broad, lips curling victoriously around her teeth. She collects her clutch from the table and he helps her with her wrap. "But I must say hello to someone first." Henri leads her across the room, careful to guide her by the elbow and not hold her hand. Stéphanie looks up as they cross the empty dance floor and waves him over. Then she is on her feet, kissing both of his cheeks before he's had the chance to greet her properly. Their table is littered with wine glasses and partially smoked gitane, and Henri sees, out of the corner of his eye, that his laughing girl is wearing a dress the color of plums. Her gown is open at the back, and a long string of pearls is looped around her neck, but worn backward, so they caress her spine. It's never occurred to him before that he could be jealous of a piece of jewelry. "Madame Marsic, a pleasure to see you again." He returns the kisses. "How is your husband?"
"The Count is away on business, as usual."
Stéphanie darts a glance from his face to Marceline's, and then to her friend. back to his. She motions to the table. Won't you join us?
We were just leaving,
Marceline says, all smile, but no joy.
Pity.
Stephanie matches the note of frost in Marceline's voice.
But Henri, you must meet my friend.
She is even lovelier up close. Large eyes. He sees now that they are green, not blue as he thought. Broad mouth, dark brows, high cheekbones. She extends one long arm and he takes her hand, fighting the urge to turn it over and kiss her palm. Nancy Wyke, she says in the strangest accent, and it takes him 3 long heartbeats to place it. Not British, not Irish, not Scottish. Australian, an exotic bird indeed. Nancy, he says, trying to pronounce it correctly. Henri Fiocca.
A pleasure to meet you.
The barest hint of a smile suggests what might be a dimple forming in her left cheek. It's all mine. And it is, clearly, because he's still holding her soft, warm hand in his. Henri lets go with a start, and she extends her hand to Marceline.
Nancy, she says.
Marceline curls both hands around his arm rather than accept the greeting.
Time to go, Henri.
This is Marceline, he tells them on her behalf, since she refuses to do so. Nancy's smile grows wider, and there it is, the fully formed dimple, just the one, and he is transfixed by its singular perfection. She lifts her wine glass from the table and tips it toward him.
Have fun with that.
She laughs, then turns back to the table, shaking her head. The last thing Henri sees as Marceline drags him across the dance floor and toward the door is Nancy's arm draped across the back of her chair, wine glass now empty, dangling upside down between 2 fingers. A long string of shiny black taxis sits at the curb outside the bar, and he steers Marceline toward the nearest one. He opens the door and helps with her dress. She scoots across the seat, patting the worn leather, expecting him to join her. Good night, he says. Fury, jealousy, and disappointment flash across her face in turn, and he thinks that perhaps she is not so pretty after all.
Henri,
she snaps, but it is an order he does not intend to follow. Thank you for joining me tonight. He hands the driver more than enough money to get her home, then shuts the door.
Fiocca and his date walk away, and Stephanie watches me staring after them. What was that about? I ask. She shrugs. Why is he here? Another shrug. He lives in Marseille. Are you kidding me? I glare at her. You did this on purpose. You invited him to the Pont Royal in Paris. You brought me to Marseille. This entire thing was a setup. Stephanie grins, not even bothering to deny it. I thought he would be a fun challenge for you. Did he know? Of course. I've been after him for months. And tonight you set this up as well? No, but I knew he favors this place. I played the odds. What about that woman? Is she a part of this? Some idiotic way of making me jealous? Are you jealous? No. Liar. She laughs. If you'd gone over to him at the Pont Royal, that woman wouldn't be an issue right now. I was there to interview Janos. Yes, but also to meet Henri. You just didn't know it. I hate him. I throw my hands up. And I hate you too. No, you don't. Damn it. What I really hate is that she can read me so well. Fine. I stand up. Challenge accepted. That's what you want, right? I'm so mad, so blood-boiling mad, at Henri, at Stephanie, at myself, that I am marching toward the entrance before I've had the chance to form any sort of plan. I push through the double doors and find Henri Fiocca standing with one foot in the street closing the door of a taxi. He gives the roof two hard thumps and it pulls away from the curb. It takes him a moment to notice me, and I study his profile, trying to read his thoughts. But then he's turning, and he sees me. Surprise, then recognition, and I think pleasure. Or relief, perhaps. A soft emotion, something tender and open, and it catches me off guard. I keep expecting him to pounce. With hands tucked into his pants pockets, he shifts, head tilted to the side, to consider me. And then he smiles. Oh, no, you don't. That famous charm will not work on me. And I wonder just how badly I'd damage that pretty face if I punched him. What are you doing here? I demand, stomping right up to him until the end of my nose is only a few inches from his collarbone. He's a good bit taller than me, and I try not to like this fact as I tilt my head up, waiting for his answer.
Nancy?
He nods, giving me the greeting I haven't afforded him.
That's a strange question.
I don't understand how you do it.
Do what?
Charm every woman you meet. First Stephanie, and now that I'm trying to be gracious, so I hedge. Blonde.
Marceline?
Her name is irrelevant. Why did you bring her tonight?
She rang me up, asked for a night on the town.
She just rang you up?
I try to mimic his nonchalant tone, the purr in his voice. Yes. He sighs as though this is some grave burden he's doomed to bear. I glare at him.
Happens often, does it?
Every girl, except for the one that I want, rings me up. And then Henri Fiocca, the most notorious heartbreaker in all of France, gives me a meaningful look, daring to lift an eyebrow. It takes a moment, one long, stuttering heartbeat to gather my laughter, but then I unleash the full force of it on him. I laugh so long and so hard that he stands there waiting for me to compose myself. But he doesn't look offended. On the contrary, Henri Fiocca looks besotted. I am unsure how I gained the advantage in this situation, but I am determined to make the most of it. If you want my company, Mr. Fiocca, you will ring me up. I leave him at the curb, astonished. By the time I return to our table, Stephanie has abandoned her cigarette and is blowing smoke rings into the air with a cigar she's confiscated from one of her many admirers. I listen to the music, relishing the feel of it rumbling across the floor and into my feet. I'm filled with the swell of it. Or perhaps I'm filled with elation from my encounter with Henri. He wasn't taking that woman home after all. Sending, yes. Taking, no. There is a huge difference between the two, and I can't decide whether to be pleased or irritated with myself that it matters. Stephanie is watching me, waiting for me to tell her everything. But I'm not ready to talk about Fiocca. Instead, I ask, how can you smoke those wretched things?
They're hideous, aren't they? I abhor the smell.
So why do it?
Because it is unexpected.
I don't understand.
Sit down.
She waves one hand at me in irritation.
That's the point, ma petite. A Parisienne always does the unexpected.
She puffs for a few seconds and then blows another smoke ring from between perfectly painted red lips.
It levels the playing field. Men don't know what to do with a woman who can clip her own cigar.
Stephanie has been slowly doling out her secrets since we met, and I, the eager pupil, gobble them up.
Teach me, I say.
She flicks a glance over my shoulder.
Perhaps tomorrow. But
I am interrupted by a waiter who is right beside me, a single drink on his tray. He places it on the table with a flourish.
Le 75 François, he says.
The French 75. Fiocca. I will not let Stephanie see me smile. I will not. Damn it.
Be careful, ma petite. You are in danger of falling in love with that man.
Stephanie taps her ash into the tray. She looks at me knowingly from beneath a fan of dark lashes.
Nonsense. I've only seen him twice.
She gives me her best pitying glance.
Are you immune to love at first sight?
It's a myth. No one falls in love that quickly. I tap my chest hard with one finger. I refuse.
Go on, refuse. The heart does what it wants. How do you think I wound up married to a Spaniard that I never see?
I consider the cocktail instead of responding. I lift the glass and twirl the stem between my fingers. Once again, the combination of gin, lemon, and champagne is exquisite. It's a bright flurry of anticipation on my tongue. And to his credit, Henri Fiocca lets me enjoy 7 full sips before he arrives at our table.
Will you dance with me?
He asks, extending his hand. I have not refused a dance yet and have no good reason to now, so I accept his hand and let him lead me to the far edge of the dance floor, away from the band and out of the thickest chaos. I have felt the man looking at me twice now, so I expect to feel something at his touch as well, and I am not disappointed. But it isn't a physical tingling or an elevated heart rate, nothing so melodramatic. It is internal, emotional. Once my hand is wrapped firmly in his, I feel calm. My entire frenetic self begins to idle, as though I've been given permission to rest. It is a foreign sensation. Henri pulls me close against his chest with one arm, then takes my free hand in his and weaves our fingers together. There's no point fighting against the dance, so I drape my arm across his back and rest my palm between his shoulder blades. He sways for a moment, finding the rhythm, and then he whirls us into the dance.
It is not a crime to enjoy the company of a beautiful woman, he says, picking up our conversation from where we left off outside.
It takes great restraint not to roll my eyes.
Could you be any more French? As a matter of fact, no. I am guilty as charged on both sides for many generations.
We dance quietly for a moment before he adds,
You say that like it's a bad thing.
Not bad, just...
What?
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, Mr. Fiocca, but you are trouble.
I am not.
And please, call me Henri. Stephanie told me so, in those exact words no less, Mr. Fiocca, I stress.
Can you at least drop the Mr.? And Stephanie is mistaken.
After seeing you with that blonde, I think I'll be keeping the Mr. for now, thank you very much.
I have known Marceline since we were children. We used to be friends.
And lovers?
For a short time.
He leans closer to my ear and whispers,
Just because I spend the evening with Marceline does not mean that I am trouble, nor does it mean that I have feelings for her.
I snort.
You think I lie?
I think it is your native tongue. Besides, it's actually worse to spend time with someone you don't like, to lead them on. He moves closer, resting his forehead against mine.
You were doing it too. You're in the most romantic city in France. You've danced all night. And from what I saw, there wasn't a scrap of chemistry between you and your last partner. But still, you danced. Besides, I wasn't leading her on. She knew up front what she was getting. A night out, nothing more.
I open my mouth, snap it shut. It's not the same. A full dance card is not the same thing as...
What? A full evening?
It's different.
No, it isn't.
Let me tell you a thing I learned from Victor Hugo.
Oh, please, Victor Hugo? Are you going to quote some obscure bit of French poetry now? Try to win me over with that accent of yours.
Henri leans so close that his breath curls into my ear. Would it work? No. Good. Besides, I wasn't going to quote poetry, just the truth. I thought they were the same thing. I hate my traitorous body for curving into his, and I hate him a little more for teaching me exactly what a tango is supposed to feel like.
Nonsense. Most poetry is garbage. Enlighten me, then. What did the great Victor Hugo tell you?
He said that when a woman is speaking to you, you must listen to what she says with her eyes. And your eyes, Nancy, say that you are attracted to me. That is the difference between this dance and your last.
So? It means nothing.
It means a great deal, given that the attraction is mutual.
It's not an unusual phenomenon for you, I'm sure. You're not exactly the sort of man who spends your evenings alone. I've seen the company you keep.
Marceline is not interested in me.
Charm and looks don't exactly grow on trees.
He flings me out to the end of his arm, then curls me back in with a snap, and I'm stunned to notice that my feet do not get tangled at all. Nor does money, which is her ultimate motivation.
That is rather unfortunate.
It is also very French. Women in this country have expectations, you know.
And women in mine do not?
I suspect women from your country are very, very different.
I don't believe you know a thing about women from Australia.
I'm trying to learn, which is why you should have dinner with me. I know a quaint place not far from here. It's still open. They serve the best bouillabaisse in the city.
No.
You're not hungry?
I'm absolutely starving.
Then eat with me.
I don't think I'm your type, Mr. Fjocka.
He seems puzzled by this. Shouldn't I be the judge of that?
Come on, it's obvious.
How?
You like blondes. I clearly don't fit the description.
Who said I like blondes?
He moves the hand at my waist to tuck a piece of hair behind my ear, letting my dark strands slide between his fingers as he does so.
I imagine that's all you ever go out with. Night after night, it's probably a parade of blondes.
One woman does not equal a parade. I shake my head, laugh at him for the 10th time this evening.
You really won't go to dinner with me?
No.
Why?
I don't remember getting a phone call from you.
I don't have your telephone number.
If you want my number, you can find it.
No dinner, but you'll dance with me?
I dance with anyone who asks, but I only dine with those who call.
I am a woman who has been possessed my entire life by great luck. I was delivered at home in the winter of 1912 by a Maori midwife in Wellington, New Zealand. And seconds after peeling the core from my face, she turned to my mother and said, "The child will be lucky from this day until the day she dies." It is the only tender story my mother ever told me about my birth, but it has proven over and over again to be true, particularly in the area of timing. No sooner do I make this pronouncement than the song ends with a flourish, and I step out of his arms.
Good night, Mr. Fjocka.